From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I just want to take this time, Mr. Urban, to address you something. I'm glad you're here tonight because I want to let you know something. I'm not interested in defeating you just because you're a Democrat. I'm interested in defeating you because you are a corrupt Democrat. And your pay-to-play politics in the city of Aurora that have led to all this nonsense taking from taxpayers and giving to people that support you, it's nonsense.
I need to bring you back.
I know many of my opponents here on the stage are attacking me, and I understand. And I get it. You know, they're threatened by the fact that I'm violating their political aspirations, and I'm hurting their political aspirations. Let me tell you why I'm Republican. My grandfather taught me when I was a young man. You know, you give a man a fish, he eats for a day. You teach him to fish, he eats for a lifetime. Democrats want to give a fish. They want to give handouts. You know, we don't need handouts. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps so I don't have to get handouts.
Well, another debate featuring Republican candidates vying for the party's nomination for governor. This one a bit different, though. All of the candidates participating, and that included Richard Urban. We heard an exchange between him and Darren Bailey and some others weighing in as well. We'll talk also about the problems facing the state's child welfare agency. That and more coming up on this episode of State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and the panel includes Charlie Wheeler. He's a professor emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois' State House editor. And joining us today, Rachel Hinton. She is the enterprise reporter with the Better Government Association, and she's been investigating DCFS. We'll talk more about that. Rachel, it's great to have you back with us.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me back.
Well, first this week, let's check in on what's happening on the political front. We're another week closer to the election. A lot of people are already voting, and the Republican primary for governor getting some headlines. Hannah, all of the candidates, as I mentioned, were on this debate panel this week. First time that's happened this election. What was the takeaway?
It's hard to say after you know, debates like this where you don't really get to much substance. There are also six people on the stage and there's just very limited time to get through that many questions. The candidates are obviously, they're not scripted, but in some moments they might as well be because they'll redirect to their own talking points, avoid the question if that's what serves them. But, also I want to point out, as Charlie pointed out before we started taping here, you know, this debate was up against a bunch of other stuff on TV. I guess the president did an address and game one of the NBA Finals and a Cubs-Cards game. And like we've been saying for months, we haven't had a summer primary in Illinois since, you know, well before my or Rachel's lifetimes. And we know that in general, folks do not pay that much attention to politics during the summer months. That's why, in traditional, campaign cycles, things kind of go a little bit quiet over the summer because the money is just not best spent, you know, when folks are lounging around the pool in July or August. But, you know, I would say though that, you know, from last night's debate, we saw most of the candidates go on the offensive against Urban. And, you know, Richard Urban, of course, the Aurora mayor, backed by Ken Griffin, the hedge fund manager, founder of Citadel. And, he's the one with the money. And another time during the debate, I think it was Jesse Sullivan, who was, himself a kind of venture capital guy, said, it's ludicrous that you have all this money, and that's what you say is, your only strength is because you're backed by the big money. And, I do think that that is a contributing factor to why he is, in the polls that we've seen. Again, these polls are all kind of different. There's still a lot of voters who say that they're undecided, but in these most recent polls, Richard Urban still leading, although Darren Bailey has definitely played the catch-up game. And, Darren Bailey in particular definitely going on the offensive there against Urban, as we heard at the top of the show. You know, Bailey has been in the triangulation game of Democratic politics, I guess you could say, the Democratic Governors Association, which has been propped up by Governor J.B. Pritzker, has, you know, gone after Irvin, hoping to face Darren Bailey in the general election, because they know that that would be an easier win for him, because just Darren Bailey, you know, it's ill. Obviously, we have lots of Republicans in Illinois, but at the end of the day, we still have the same voting patterns. And when elections now come down to the suburbs, Darren Bailey just does not play as well in the suburbs as a Richard Irvin would.
So, Rachel, you watched this as well. What did you think of the candidates last night?
I'd echo basically what Hannah said. It seemed like, and Dave McKinney at WBEZ talked about this in his story, Irvin was the pinata. It kind of felt like everyone, not everyone, but Darren Bailey, Jesse Sullivan, those two specifically really sought to attack Irvin. And I think that's because Irvin has largely, I'm not going to say hidden from public view, or he's not been very responsive to the media. He hasn't been doing a whole bunch of press conferences, interviews, things of that sort. He's tried to lay low. And so I think that those two specifically really wanted to ding him as much as possible and bring up some of the attacks that we see in ads and have seen them say in their own press releases or other press conferences to publicly kind of take Irvin down a notch. I think it kind of resolidified that, you know, Irvin is the one to watch here. Irvin is the you know, kind of number one target. I think that's why we saw, you know, Darren Bailey, like the clip you played at the top of the show, saying, you know, I'm not just trying to defeat you because you're a Democrat, it's because you're a corrupt Democrat. I think that, you know, people watching at home who may not be following this as closely, you know, might have questions about that. What do they mean? You know, what did Bailey mean when he called him a corrupt Democrat? I mean, I think that that alludes to some of the great reporting we've seen from the Tribune on stuff from Irvin. I mean, I think that it signifies that this is kind of the final countdown, and everyone knows it. Everyone really feels it. And I think that's why we saw the gloves. I mean, the gloves were already off, but it was even more apparent last night that people know what's at stake and they're really trying to fight for this before June 28th.
Yeah, Charlie, I mean, Irvin had to know that these attacks were coming, right?
Oh, yeah. And I think Dave McKinney on WBEZ pointed out that in this debate, Irvin served as a political pinata for the other five candidates. And he's the front runner. And his, let's say, his Republican credentials are suspect in some respects because he was elected nonpartisan elections in Aurora. He says he was elected as a Republican. Well, actually, they don't run on partisan labels. He voted in Democratic primaries. And as his opponents point out, he said favorable things about Pritzker and about Pritzker's way of dealing with the pandemic. He also said he was conflicted about whether or not he should send the police out when the riots occurred with the protesters in the Black Lives Matter situation a couple of years ago. And he's on the record of doing all these things that makes him seem sort of like a Democrat. And he's tried to walk back all that. He said, oh, no, I'm a Republican now. And the suspicion, I guess, is that he's been remade or refashioned the way that Ken Griffin's handlers want him to be to try and beat J.B. Pritzker. So my takeaway was that there really wasn't anything new in that debate other than the unique quality of having all six people, five in person, one by Zoom, on the same stage at the same time. There were no new ideas that came out. Some of the ideas I thought were really goofy. No offense, but Sullivan says, well, I'm going to cut $10 billion from the budget. Well, where's that money going to come from? Well, as usual, you know, we're going to get rid of waste and fraud. We're going to be more efficient. That's the same malarkey that's been peddled for as long as I've been watching this stuff. I think it's safe to say I've been watching this longer than anybody else on the panel. And there's no specifics there. And not, as I say, not to pick on him, some of the other guys are equally goofy. I thought Max Solomon says that we're going to put armed guards in every school. How's that going to work out? And so maybe the most illuminating thing was something that Darren Bailey said when one of the questions that was posed was, how will you be able to work with a Democratic General Assembly? Because there's nobody in the world who expects that Republicans are going to win control of the legislature in November. The best that Republicans are hoping for, I believe, is to reduce the supermajorities so that were they to elect the governor, and he vetoes stuff that Democrats passed, his veto would be sustained. But anyway, Bailey says, and I'm quoting him here now, there are many Democrats that think like we do around this circle, meaning the candidates, they were in a semicircle. But unfortunately, they feel hindered that they won't get reelected if they subscribe to these policies of freedom and lower taxes and safe streets, Bailey says. When I have the pulpit, when I'm able to express that message, we'll have many come along and we'll be able to work together because we must. So I'm thinking to myself, if your position is that Democrats kind of like your ideas, but they're afraid to endorse them because they won't get reelected. Well, what that says to me is that your ideas aren't popular with their constituents. Now, I don't know if that was the point Bailey intended to make, but that's what struck me about it. I'm suspecting that we are probably a significant portion of the people who actually watched the debate with all the other competition, the Cubs and the Cardinals, the Celtics and the Warriors, the president. I'm guessing probably not that many people are going to watch it. And it was streamed as opposed to being on the air. Tonight it's going to be on the air at 10:30. I'm not sure how many people are going to want to stay up to watch that. So it was kind of one of those things. Yeah, we're going to have a debate. And it's like, ho-hum, who cares?
Well, Rachel, there were a couple of, I guess, notable endorsements made this week in this race. One of those was not the one Darren Bailey has been seeking so much, but he did get Steve Bannon to endorse him. And also the Tribune editorial board has come out in support of somebody who's really not gotten much attention or much traction in this race, Paul Shimp, former congressman. What is, do those help at all? Does this seem to elevate some of those candidates a bit or not?
I think it could potentially help Schimpf, but he is at a significant disadvantage with getting his message out on TV. And so you have to wonder if, Chicago Republicans, if Chicagoland Republicans are going to, vote for him or cast their ballot for him later this month. The Tribune even kind of acknowledges that in its editorial and its endorsement, saying, look, we understand people are going to probably vote tactically, but we really encourage you to vote for this guy. He seems sharp. He seems willing and able to work with, Democrats, reach across the aisle. He's done that so far. Don't just vote tactically, vote for someone who could really advance the state and work and compromise with others. I don't know that that'll be helpful. I think that other newspapers, other media outlets would have to give the same endorsement. I think Schimpf would have to get, a big money donor like Griffin, like Richard Uihlein. And I just don't see that happening. And I don't see that being helpful for him this late in the game. But it was, a nicely penned endorsement, I guess. The Steve Bannon endorsement, while not the one that Bailey has been seeking and really vying for, really pushing for, I think will help him. Steve Bannon was obviously a very close advisor and friend to the former president, at least for a while. So I think that those who are on the far right or who listen to and care about what Steve Bannon has to say, who he supports, I think that could help Senator Bailey. But I don't know that, Steve Bannon's seal of approval matters as much to them as the president's, nod or endorsement.
Well, we are talking politics, and that's the Republican side. But what about on the Democratic side, Hannah? There's some drama going on there as well. Maybe not as high a profile to the general public, but what's happening behind the scenes over there?
It seems like just yesterday, although it also seems like several lifetimes ago, now that former House Speaker Mike Madigan stepped away from his longtime post as head of the Democratic Party of Illinois. And Robin Kelly, Congresswoman Robin Kelly, rather, from South Suburban Matson, you know, took over as chair of DPI after a kind of contentious race, kind of a, what would you say, a proxy war between, you know, those most notably Dick Durbin, Senator Dick Durbin, who backed Robin Kelly, and the kind of J.B. Pritzker camp, who backed Alderwoman Michelle Harris. Robin Kelly has announced her intention to run again for party chair. And she's, you know, again, facing some opposition. And so that'll be really interesting to see how that shakes out. You know, Governor Pritzker, because he is the one in Illinois who holds the most money, obviously, as a billionaire, as a self-funded candidate, he has set up his own kind of thing that I guess you could say competes with the party apparatus. Robin Kelly, you know, as a sitting congresswoman, you know, one of the big objections was that she couldn't raise what's called soft money, which is for state races. And there was ultimately a solution that was come to after many months of trying to get the Federal Election Commission's opinion on this. And so there was kind of a separate workaround committee set up. I think most other states, their parties work in concert. And that's not to say that under Madigan, it was, you know, like most other state parties, because it was not. It was mostly, you know, his kind of operation to benefit mostly his House members to make sure that he maintained a majority so he could remain Speaker. And it really was kind of also an operation that got them discounts on mail, basically, so they could send out all these mailers in those races, which is kind of an old school thing. Still, you know, just as it's ever been, it's never a united Democratic front in Illinois. And you know, one other interesting thing that happened this week is that Pritzker had endorsed a former state rep who served one term from Lake County. Her name is Mary Edley Allen. She was beat out in 2020 by a Republican, but she is back again, trying to get the Senate seat that is being vacated by Melinda Bush, a longtime state senator. And so the governor endorsed Mary Edley Allen over State Rep Sam Yingling, who is one of the openly gay legislators in Illinois. And Yingling said that Pritzker's non-endorsement was an attack on him and the community.
Well, let me turn the attention now to the state's Child Welfare Agency, the Department of Children and Family Services. Rachel, I mentioned you've been focused. In fact, wrote for the Better Government Association an article. The piece looked at DCFS and basically called it a state agency in crisis. So just how bad is it?
As the agency has seen, you know, more children kind of come into its care in the 2 years since July, my colleague David Jackson and I found that over 1,100 foster children have been held improperly in settings like the Cook County Juvenile Temporary Detention Center. They've been forced to sleep on air mattresses in offices or emergency rooms, and others have been housed beyond, you know, their release dates, beyond doctors cleared them to be released in psychiatric hospitals. And judges like Judge Patrick Murphy, who has found Director Mark Smith in contempt of court a number of times, you know, said, what do I do when it seems that this agency is abusing kids, even though the agency is supposed to be preventing that abuse? That plus employees feel largely unsupported. They feel like their safety concerns and requests have largely fallen on deaf ears, or rather they worry that, you know, they could be next when going out to these homes to either take custody of children or to investigate, you know, calls for abuse. And also children are dying. There have been, I believe, 6 deaths since last December, which has caused lawmakers and child advocates to really kind of push for greater insight into what's going on in the agency, demand answers from Mark Smith, and just generally kind of ring the alarm bell that something is going on here and the agency needs help. What that help looks like, mostly people we spoke to said that it doesn't look like they need resources. It doesn't look like they necessarily need more money. It looks like they need better direction. Where that direction comes from obviously remains to be seen. Mark Smith has not resigned, does not seem like he's going to resign anytime soon. When we spoke to him, he said, you know, I think we're doing the right thing. So I'm willing to take all the abuse and the disrespect and everything else, because I think that what we're doing is right, and these things take time. But again, child advocates and lawmakers are asking how much time, can we afford to give? And I think that, you know, that question's kind of underscored by the recent death, the death over the weekend of an 8-year-old girl in Uptown in Chicago. And, you know, I think a day before or hours before or something of that sort, a very short amount of time, her home was visited by a DCFS investigator. And they didn't see, you know, any signs of abuse. And people I've spoken to within the agency are saying, well, yeah, like she didn't seem, you know, there may not have been signs, but how can we know, you know, that this is going to turn into a murder and attempted suicide sort of thing? But again, people are really watching this and worried about what this signifies for the agency, what it signifies for especially the kids in its care.
Yeah, I was a little struck by the interview with Smith, director, where he mentioned that he basically said, you know, been there 3 years, it's not enough time to turn things around. Is that a fair statement?
You know, I could see it going both ways. Smith in that interview really pointed to and you know, kind of followed in Governor Pritzker's footsteps and kind of blaming outside forces, blaming Governor Rauner and the budget impasse that really gutted the social services, that cut beds and things of that sort. And him saying, look, this agency wasn't built overnight. It wasn't built in 3 years. You know, I can't be expected to reestablish the beds, the relationships with private agencies, so on and so forth in 3 years, which, sure, is kind of fair. I understand where he's coming from. But from the outside perspective, from the perspective of child advocates, from lawmakers, from just concerned citizens watching this, I do think it's fair to question the 3-year statement of, well, what have you been doing? What can you point to right now as a win or as a success in terms of providing care for these kids in DCFS custody? And so I think that I can see both sides, but I think given the amount of time and the amount of money that has gone, you know, in the various budgets to DCFS, I do understand why people are questioning where the agency currently stands 3 years into Smith's tenure.
Yeah, just a few seconds left here, Charlie, but I wanted to bring you in. You follow this agency. We've talked before about it being such a difficult job, so, you know, certainly you can give them that. And all the problems that can come up in this type of agency. But, you know, your thoughts on what this article has pointed out.
I think it's pointed out a longstanding problem with not having enough caseworkers who are available to do the kind of diligence and follow-up that's needed. In the case of a little 8-year-old girl that Rachel mentioned, DCFS worker visitor, and then there was no contact for like 2 months, despite the fact that the DCFS rules themselves say that in cases like this, a caseworker is supposed to go out every 24 hours to make sure the kid is okay, including weekends and holidays. So they went 2 months without doing anything, and then lo and behold, they find the little girl smothered by her mother. Her mother tried to commit suicide, and the police said that the mother was high on PCP when they came. And so the public guardian, Cook County, is really, really, what would you say, like incensed about this. He says, this case screamed out for intensive mental health services for the mother, for drug services for the mother, and at least some type of protective supervision plan. But when you have investigators laboring under untenable caseloads in an inept bureaucracy without the support they need, the ball is going to get dropped on investigations with tragic results like what happened here. And so I'm not sure really how you solve that problem. And a lot of it goes back to the fact you need to invest more in getting more caseworkers. You probably have to pay them more than whatever we're paying them now. And you have to really be diligent about following up on these cases. And as a matter of fact, the caseworker and the immediate supervisor were both suspended because apparently the supervisor didn't check to see if the caseworker was doing what the caseworker was supposed to do. So they've been suspended while DCFS quote investigates close quote this particular case.
It's time now for our notes from the field. Hannah, let's go to you first.
The Tribune has a story this week. Former Governor Jim Thompson had passed away in, I believe, August of 2020. This weekend up in Winnetka, his family is having an estate sale. He was a prolific collector of tchotchkes, knickknacks, whatever you want to call it. I went to former Comptroller Judy Bartopinka's estate sale in 2015 and found it very interesting.
Okay, Rachel?
I've been following the Cook County assessor's race. The husband of candidate Carrie Steele, Mays Jackson, was dinged again this week for comments he made on his radio show. A few weeks ago, Jewish legislators called him out for some anti-Semitic comments he made, specifically those related to a consultant who's working for Fritz Kagi. A week or two after that, Latino lawmakers sent a similar letter saying, hey, you can't say things, why are you saying things that are against Latinos? And recently, I believe earlier this week, LGBTQ lawmakers sent another similar statement calling him out for homophobic comments he's made on his radio show. So just following the response to that as that race also heats up in the remaining weeks.
Okay, and Charlie.
Well, it's time for our monthly update from Professor J. Fred Geertz at the Institute for Government and Public Affairs at the U of I Champaign with his flash index. The flash index dropped 0.3 points in May to 105.7, but the Illinois economy is still growing. And the professor says uncertainty in the state and national economies are still unresolved. He points out unemployment is falling in Illinois. Consumer spending remains strong. Job openings are plentiful. Tax receipts exceed forecasted levels. But this growing economy, nonetheless, there's increasing concern about a recession coming up. And the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, the legislature's fiscal gurus, reported that through the first 11 months of the current fiscal year, overall base receipts are up $4.75 billion for FY22, which is obviously good news.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Rachel Hinton with the Better Government Association. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app or iTunes. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.